Welcome to our study in Romans, our 36th lesson, Who Can Resist God? Now, before we dive into our lesson, I want to begin with three salient points from our last lesson to put us in the right frame of mind. We have to remember that all of this is predicated around God's will of election. This is what Paul is explaining. And of course, the bigger context here is Paul is explaining this because he's telling us what happened to the Jews. Why are there churches? Why are we not all in synagogues? Why are the churches going primarily Gentile? Has God done away with His people? Has God done away with His law? Has God done away with everything that was in the Old Testament? And Paul is going to give us an answer, but it's an involved answer, as most good answers are. And he's doing it step by step. So we have to accept that God works by election. And he uses both Abraham as a metaphor and Rebecca's travail in childbirth to show that not only is God choosing, but God's choosing has nothing to do with the individuals that are chosen or not chosen. That's why Rebecca is a metaphor for this. Her unborn children had done absolutely nothing. They were both conceived in sin, and accomplished absolutely nothing. Both were in need of salvation, but both had done absolutely nothing yet. And God's making it clear he doesn't do it because he looks down through the corridors of time and see who's the mess up and who isn't. So he chooses the one who isn't. That is a spurious excuse. It seeks to excuse God, thinking that God is doing evil by not choosing people to go to heaven. Thus it's God who's sending them to hell. But God says he doesn't do that. People send themselves to hell. Then they stand before his court to give an account. It is appointed unto people once to die, and then the judgment. And do you make the cut? Well, none of us do. But God chooses to save some. And we have to remember that fair is not a biblical concept because that is what's going through your head right now. God is not fair. Yep, that's quite true. God is not fair. Fair is not in the Bible. Fair is sameness. We all have to be exactly the same, or everything has to be equal, or it's not right. Well, that's not in the scriptures, not even in real life. Deservedness. Everyone gets what they deserve. Those who have more talent and work harder get what they deserve. They get more because they earned it. And those who, well, they weren't so lucky, they didn't have the talent, or they didn't have the work ethic, or they didn't have the right circumstances, they don't get as much. That's too bad. But if we all got what we deserved, we'd all be going down. Because to be quite honest, the moment you're conceived, you're hellbound. You don't do anything to go to hell. You are conceived. You have no choice in that. You have no agreement or disagreement or nothing. It is the work of other people who decide, or not, to conceive you. And that sets you on your pathway to hell. And it's God who then pulls some out. But man wants God to be fair so that everybody gets to miss the lake of fire. Universalism. But that is not fair in and of itself because it requires that God violate his own nature. And finally, does God harden people? It says right there in the scriptures, God hardened Pharaoh. So that everybody down through history could see God's power and glory and grace. But when you read the account, who is doing the hardening? Pharaoh. And the one behind him, Satan. The more successful they are, the more they're believing the delusion, 2 Thessalonians 3 through 12, the more God allows them to believe that delusion that he's sending them. The more hardened they become in their position. So in a sense, no, God is not actively saying, I'm going to harden you and you're never going to understand the truth. God doesn't have to do that. You're already asabeia, ungodly. You already have rejected God and his truth. That is the quality of sin nature. God, there is no reason God needs to make it harder, make you more dense. You have already rejected everything of God. That is what sin does. That is what the sin nature is. Rejects God. It is foolishness to that person. It's foolishness to me. When I was lost. So what is hardening? I mean, what is happening? God is not rescuing them. God is letting them go. So Paul then turns around and asks the questions here in verse 19. And he asks two of them. They're right together. He says, why does he still find fault? Who can resist his will? In other words, I can't resist the will of God. Why is it my fault? I cannot resist my sin nature. Why is it my fault? That's what Paul is asking. That is what the lost person asks. That is what every sinner asks when they get caught, saved or lost. Now we have to understand how Paul began his original discussion here in Romans, in chapter 1. Verses 18 through 25, in fact, all the way to the end of the chapter, is he says that God gives them up. God is not in the business of running around beating people up who are rejecting him, who insult him. He doesn't need to take them out. That is what lost works-based religions do. They run around and terrorize you. It's Islam, or it's Catholicism, or it's whatever. You either agree with us, or we are against you. And if we have power, we will make it hard on you, and even kill you. Protestantism is doing the same thing. True Christianity has no need, because God has no need. We should not be in the business of trying to force people to understand and agree and accept the gospel. Because they can't. You cannot win a person by logic because it's foolishness to them. You cannot win a person by force because they will just lie. You cannot win a person by being nice because they think you're an idiot. No one can be saved except God enlighten him or her. So what does he find fault? Well, that's what we're discussing today. Now notice what God is doing here. God does not hide the truth, but the truth to the lost is lost. It's foolishness. They've rejected it. Because Satan does hide the gospel from them. And more than that, Paul is asking these questions from the perspective of a lost person, not a saved person. Paul is not having an intellectual discussion here in which he's asking these questions so that we can have this Augustine-like discussion or Aquinas perspective philosophical discussion, because that is not what Paul does. That is not what God does. God is not interested in having a philosophical discussion. Because a philosophical discussion comes from the perspective of lost sin nature. And so Paul is asking these questions from that perspective. But the answers he gives are from God's perspective. And so what is the supposition or the presupposition of the lost person? Well, that God finds fault with people. God's running around and he's condemning everyone. He's finding fault and he's going, you did this, you lied, you cheated, blah, 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 you did all these things, and thus I find fault. Well, who can resist your will? And then the lost person follows up with that charge, as I just reiterated, and I'm going to repeat it again for emphasis. Who can resist his will? And what is the sinner actually doing? They're blaming God for their sin rather than accepting responsibility and ask forgiveness, which God wants to give, as we're going to see going through this lesson and reading the Bible verses. It's very interesting that Paul is phrasing it from this perspective, because sinners, saved and lost, because saved people still sin, even though they have a new nature, they have the old body of flesh. But sinners have little shame in the midst of their sin and gladly seek to shift the blame of their sin from themselves to others and ultimately to God. It's God's fault I sinned. It's God's fault that I don't understand. Holy Spirit is supposed to teach me. You didn't teach me this. It's not my fault. Where'd they get this from? Well, we have to turn to the scriptures, which I always like to do. And we have to go back to Genesis, which I really like to do. And we have to go back to the original sin of man and woman in the garden with the very first sin. Because man, Adam, because in the Hebrew, that's the word for man is Adam, who deliberately sinned. And we get this out of Paul, out of the New Testament. Eve was deceived, woman was deceived, but man was not. He deliberately sinned. He knew what he was doing. And yet when God came walking in the garden and found them and asked them what happened, What did man do? He blamed the woman, and then he blamed God who gave him the woman. It is all your fault. In fact, he says, the man said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree and I ate. Thus it's the woman that you gave to me. It's your fault. You hadn't given me her. Or if you'd fixed her, if you gave me a better one, give me one that wouldn't be doing this. See it? So it's not my fault. It's your fault and hers. So you go talk to them because I got nothing to do with this. When in fact, he had everything to do with it. Everything. Because he deliberately sinned. And how about the Hebrews? After God graciously moved the Hebrews out of Egypt, freed them from the grip of Pharaoh, they consistently tested him and blamed him and Moses for their apparent deprivations. That is what Exodus is about. And Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and Judges, and the rest of the Old Testament. It's how they put God to the test. Why? Because it's God's fault. And what happened? Nearly every person who came out of Egypt died in their sin in the wilderness due to their unbelief, which constantly and consistently blamed God rather than look to him for help and faith. They could have just prayed to God, we're out of water out here. We're in your hands. We're totally dependent upon you. And we will sit here knowing that you will provide the water. You will not let us die. And if you do, we just get to come home earlier. It'd be all right. Because then we don't have to worry about the water. But that's not how they did it. And so when Paul is asking these questions, he's revealing their sinfulness, the evil in the sinner's heart. Since they do not seek forgiveness, they seek to show that God is evil. And that, of course, is theodicy, blaming God for evil. Why is there evil in the world? If God is sovereign, all-powerful, why is there evil? Well, there's evil because God has to allow evil. Thus, that makes God responsible for evil. Anytime you get in these intellectual discussions, you're going to end up blaming God. You're going to end up testing God. Now, the problem is when we look at the mindset that brings these type of charges, only a God can charge a God. Got to be on equal terms. Little above. You know, I can't go to a court and judge them. When I go to a court, I'm being judged. Because they're above me, they have the authority, and so on and so forth. And what was Satan's lie to woman in Genesis 3:5? Only God. In 3:4, actually. But the serpent said to the woman, you shall not surely die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Notice. That is what God, as what Satan said to her, that she would be as God. And that is man's mindset. in our lost state, that is our mindset, that we are gods. And thus we can judge God because he's God too. And we can judge him then and find him wanting because he does not meet our criteria. The sinners reveal the true heart's intents when they test God, because they're rarely seeking to find him guilty of their sin to absolve themselves. That is the whole point of this. Is that they seek to find God unjust. Therefore, God's sentence against them, that they go to the lake of fire for all eternity, they claim is unjust, and that God is unjust, and that God made them, therefore everything is God's fault. And if everything is God's fault, God is unjust. That's the charge right here. Why does he find fault, and who can resist his will? And if you do not analyze the foundation from which those questions spring, you're being led into a false dilemma. Because obviously the answer is, who can resist God? No one. Why does he still find fault? Because he just mean. And he does. And it's not right. Because he's made me like this. They seek to put God on the defensive, to have him defend himself via their false dilemma, implies that God is the source of their sin rather than themselves. Now, this seems like a good position. It appeals to us. It appeals to our flesh. It appeals to our mind. It appeals to our fairness. It appeals to everything that we hold dear. And that's a real problem, because it's all evil. It's all sinful. Because God rejects the sinner's false dilemma. What do you do when you're in a discussion and someone is asking you these pointed questions, trying to lead you to a wrong conclusion to trap you in your argument? That's the false dilemma. You don't fall into it. You don't answer their question. You expose their question for what it is, and then you give them a true perspective. Now, that is what God is going to be doing. He's not going to answer the question, because it's a false dilemma question. To answer it puts you on the horns of a dilemma. If you answer it, of course you're evil. If you answer in the affirmative, you're evil. If you answer in the negative, then you're weak. And you're not God. So how does God answer them? Well, he, through Paul, refers to the metaphor of the potter. Now, when I was a child, being stationed overseas, you know, my parents, we were in third world countries, and we would go downtown and see potters in their little shops throwing clay on the wheel and turning it, and while it's spinning around with clay on it, they're running their hands over it, and they're making stuff. And it's amazing what they can make in just a few moments. Of course, that's only the very first step. Then they set it aside, and then let it dry, and then they have to smooth it out and glaze it and bake it, and it's this whole process. And you can come out with a very elegant piece of pottery. It can be very beautiful. It can be valuable centuries, if not millennia later, like some actually is today. But, you know, this is really more than a metaphor. Because God literally made the dirt out of nothing. Bara. And clay is the type of dirt. you don't believe it, just go to Georgia. All that red stuff on the ground, that dirt, that's clay. And God literally made it. Then God literally made man from that dirt. And then from man, he cloned woman. So woman's made from, ultimately, from dirt also. So when God says he is the potter, we look on it as a metaphor, but in point of fact, it is actual fact. He made everything. And then he made man. Thus, he is the real potter, and mankind is actually the clay. God literally fashions each person individually as he wills, according to his own counsel, without consulting mankind. And that's because when he was doing all this creating stuff, no one was there. And no one today can even define soul. No one today can even understand what occurs at conception. Physically, which is empirically, and spiritually, which is non-empirical. We don't have a clue. We just know what happens. You know, cells divide, and eventually they specialize, and you have arteries, you have veins, you have heart, you got, how's it happen? I don't know. Don't have a clue. God does. And God fashions each and every individual. Well, here's the thing. Sinners try to be potters. Now, if you're struggling with that, where do you think the abortion movement comes from? That is how mankind tries to be the potter. Since we can't fix what's broke or what we don't like, what we're going to do is throw it away. Unfortunately, it's not ours to do that with. And we look back in history. From ancient times, sinners like the false Jews who had God's truth stood in judgment of God. Now, this was the issue at Meribah. Now, Meribah happened in Exodus. They're out in the wilderness, and they ran out of water, and they said, God brought us out here to kill us. And we don't like God now. And Moses, since you're God's representative, we hate you too. And since we can't see God, we're just going to stone you instead. And God said, hit the rock, and the water came out. But this showed us their character. The character of sinners. There were very, very few that believed God. After all he did in Egypt, and had done to Pharaoh's army, and was leading them with a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. And they could not believe. That's why most of them died. They rejected God. Well, this was their history, such that when Christ came, they rejected him. Because he did not meet their criteria of a conquering Messiah. Of course, they envisioned themselves as the conquering Messiah's leaders so that he would be forced to follow them and they'd tell him what to do and who to conquer and who to enslave so that the whole world would be their slaves. That was kind of their agenda. And if God was not going to do that, then they found God lacking. And just because he came and said he was the Son of God, if we can kill him, he's not God. So they killed him, and then they decided he wasn't God. They missed the whole point. They had the scriptures, but they couldn't understand them. Some did. Absolutely, throughout time. There were always a remnant that believed. But by and large, most of them did not. And it's that way today in the church. And guess what? Man's works-based religions seek to enslave everyone else to themselves in a similar fashion, whether it's Christendom or Islam or whatever. Lost man is always trying to enslave others. Always. So God wants to clarify his relationship to mankind. God rejected sinful man's premise that they're gods and can judge him. And asked each of us, as he asked of Job, why we seek to be gods over gods. In verse 20 in Romans 9, God says, but who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Well, what does molded say to its molder? Why have you made me like this? Has a potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for dishonorable use? In fact, he's just asking a series of questions that are forcing us into an answer. But it's an answer based not because it's a false dilemma answer, but because it's based on truth. It's based on fact. Thus, mankind does not want to engage in those answers because it will destroy their arguments. Because what God is actually bringing up here is property rights. And everybody believes in property rights. It's mine. I bought it. I made it. I own it. It's mine. You can't take it. And because it's mine, I can do with it what I want. As long as I don't hurt others and so on and so forth. And we all agree with that. If something is yours, I can't just walk in and take it. That's called stealing. And there's penalties for that, as there should be. And God said, I created all this. I brought all this into existence. All of this is mine. And you're telling me what I can do with mine? Well, that's what government does. That's why government is developed by laws of man. Because government wants to tell you what to do. Government wants to take from you. Government wants to redistribute to whom it will so it can stay in power and get more votes or whatever. Well, that's not what God does. God is not buying us. Otherwise, he would be giving us the answers that would soothe us and calm our souls and our spirits and make us self-satisfied in our lost frame of mind and our sinful worldviews. But he's just not going to do that. Because he does not think like we think. He says, do I not have the ownership? And being the owner, do I not have the right to dispose of the property as I desire? I don't come and take your stuff. And their answer would be yes. Now, people can't own people. That slavery is never a good thing, never a good outcome. And that's not what God is discussing here. Because God is saying, I'm giving the lost up. I'm letting them go and have their own way like they want. At some point, we're going to sit down and have this discussion of judgment. Because at some point, all this is running down, and there's going to be an end point. And we'll see who has done what.